There was an old school on 4th Avenue in Vancouver. And we took over that for a while. And that's where I graduated, if you like. And then they commissioned me and sent me overseas. It was as simple as that.
Can you tell me something more about the training, or the language training? Were the instructors Japanese?
What were they? Yes, some of them were Japanese. And there were a good number of Nisei introduced into the class as well. They were also Caucasians, such as Colonel McKenzie and a number of others who were born in Japan or were experienced in Japan, who were our teachers. A chap called Griffith, who'd been a member of the embassy in Japan and whose wife was Japanese, and she was a very wonderful lady indeed. It was an excellent training in Japanese of the time, particularly official Japanese, military Japanese, but not particularly colloquial Japanese.
Did you receive training in Japanese society and culture, or was it purely linguistic training?
No, it wasn't purely. We received a lot of, from Mrs. Griffith, at least some of us more than others, I guess. I've always been very, very interested in other people's rituals. Anyway, I know I'm perfectly happy in Indian ritual, Malay ritual. I have a smattering on some of the Chinese ritual. So I naturally studied also, tried to make myself conversant as I could with Japanese gradations of necessary ritual in addressing and dwelling with and operating with my inferiors, my peers, and my superiors. Knowing all the time that if we won the war, of course, I'd go over as a superior anyway.
Were you preparing for losing the war and being an inferior?
No, not a bit. Being somewhat piratical by nature, I was anticipating going back to do some looting. But it was a damn good training that we got in language and in translation, as well as not only just the matter of interpreting, but translating as well in social. I have a whole course down below, the whole written course, books and the whole bit.
You've kept all those?
I kept them all.
Did you have books about the Japanese as a people? Kind of anthropology or...
Anthropological aspect of it. Oh yes, to a certain degree, but it was only touched on through small history books and that sort of thing. Stories, certain rituals. Mrs. Griffith was the great one on these things. She would teach us proper manners upon entering the house.
Was she Japanese?
Yes. She was good family Japanese, too, to boot, I discovered later. I knew nothing about the Japanese, except I was extremely... Don't forget, I was imbued then, as much as anyone else, with a fear of them and a dislike of them and a great sense of wanting to get back at something that had been done to me that I didn't want done. But you get to people like Mrs. Griffith and one or two others that we had there who were perfectly wonderful people, and you begin to realize, of course, that not any people are tarred by the same brush. Each one has their heroes, and I suppose if there really was one, Mrs. Griffith was it, because she was an exile and had been... You have to realize that at a time when it was an extremely dangerous, if you like, or an extremely lowering thing to do, she had married a Caucasian. She not only lost face, she lost family, and she lost caste. But she did it. And she was a very beautiful person. She was much older than, of course, than we were, but we knew about her. And she taught us manners as well as language.
Was this all very hush-hush?
Yes, I think it was.
the most
part.
You were not supposed to tell people what you were doing?
No, we weren't supposed to. We weren't even... I was allowed over on weekends because I was married, otherwise I wouldn't have been let out of the joint, I'm sure.
Of course, that was at a time when many of the Japanese had been evacuated and dispossessed.
Yes, which was a very nasty thing indeed.
Do you think most people here thought it was nasty, though, at the time?
No, I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure that everyone else, I thought it was probably a safe thing to do under the circumstances. But the injustices that would arise out of it, I hadn't even dreamed of. It wasn't until later that I really realized that the true injustice of the whole thing.
What was the true injustice of the whole thing?
That they were Canadian citizens, and they didn't deserve that kind of treatment at all. You don't take your Canadian peoples and stuff them into camps because they happen to be of the color of the enemy. Why didn't you take all the German and why didn't you take all the Italians and do exactly the same thing? You bet you didn't. You only took those what you knew were conversant Nazis and stuffed them into concentration camps. But the Japanese, you just took them holy spolus and you robbed them blind and threw them out because you were frightened. We were all frightened. It was something new, it was strange. We hadn't been attacked by the Japanese before. We'd been attacked by Germany before, so that wasn't too bad. We knew we could deal with that. But we weren't quite sure how to deal with the Japanese. I know this was true until about halfway through the war, when people like Mountbatten and a few others drove some guts back into us. It made us realize that the Japanese soldier was a patriot, and a brave man, but he was human, he could be beaten. He just was a little better than we were at it, though. It took us a long time to find out. He could starve, and when he was starved, his morale went down, like everybody else's. He could live under fire for so long, and he might die for his emperor. Much more devoted people than we were, you know. Much more feudal. It's one of the things I really liked about the Japanese, I suppose, was their feudal aspect and their sense of tradition. In many, many respects, I suppose, of the traditions which they had and the ideals that they upheld, they were somewhat like the British were purported to be at one time or another.
What role did you think you would play? The downfall of the Japanese?
Oh, administrative only. Administrative. As far as I was concerned, once the war was over, and I'm jumping ahead a bit now, when we were in Malaya, and the war was over, and we actually got back to Malaya, it was a very, very, very different thing. See, I'd had a very, very early experience with Japanese, which I haven't mentioned so far.
Mention it now.
All right. It'll go back to the first time that I went to Malaya. It goes back on board the ship upon which I went, and I went over there with a girl who was Japanese, not an Issei. She was Japanese born, I can't remember this, and she was alone on board that ship, and there was myself, and there was an Italian medical student. And the girl had been, she'd married in the States, but she had a form of family connection that when she was called back to go to Japan, she went. But she married a Caucasian, and things weren't good, and her family said, you shall come back, and she had to go back. She went back, because, I can't exactly remember the whole thing, but it was very, very pleasant because we got to know her, these two men, young men in their 22, 23, of a rather romantic age. It all came about because one or two members of the crew made a pass at her one day, and we happened to be close by, and we went for the crew and said, now look, far enough. don't go, don't do any more, because it, you know, it made her, it should, I haven't, you know, it made her weep. And so from then on, we kept a very close eye on us, and she kept on her, and she kept a very close eye on Alfredo and myself, if I remember his name particularly, until we got through to Yokohama on the trip. And on our way through from Yokohama, she gave us both a small something or other card and a small shrine and some punk what's name to good and something written on a scroll which she handed to each of us, and each our names on it. And what I liked about it later, when it was translated, it was to my name, literally translated from in kanji, Japanese, to who helped me, and it was to Johnson Samurai, who helped when it was needed.
Very nice.
So then I realized that she had viewed this Italian chap as her particular personal samurai. So, as I say, it had been a personal and rather, if you like, romantic, what's the word they used to use about this back when? We can't say it was a sex attraction thing. It was, I don't know, it was
romantic,
it was a simple romantic connection. Like, I suppose, the one that Dante would look at.
A platonic
attraction, which we respected her from her distance, and she respected us from our distance. Yet we played always her companion and her protectors. When she wanted to go anywhere or she needed something to be done, we were there to do it, sort of idea. And I suppose that one or two of the other passengers considered this a little bit strange, because we were looking after this particular girl in this particular way. And I only say this to you now because I discussed it with the medical student who was on his way actually out to Macau. We discussed it later as to what it all we thought. And we said, yes, perhaps we were a little strange. Maybe we haven't grown up. Oh, who shall say? That's the early small thing. I'm sorry, it's not very interesting, yet it had
a
profound...
Well, it is interesting because, you know, you didn't mention it before, and now this was a connection with Japan.
Yeah. Which gave me a wonderful view of that particular person and the Japanese. And she, of course, talked a great deal about the history of her people and a great deal about the rituals and so forth and so on. And this is where I had my beginnings.
And of course, it would prevent you from stereotyping all Japanese
yep,
people.
That's
the
right.
Same as
that's correct.
And,
yep. I'm afraid it did. I'm afraid it did. And I can't say I wasn't one of those that wasn't relieved when the Japanese left the coast. Yes, I was. But I can't say that I was ever able, even though I got beaten all the way down out of Singapore and across the straits and through, and that they gave me one hell of a scare, that when the war was over, I was damn glad to get back and sit down and have a bowl of rice with them, because it was over.
When you were in the Japanese language school,
yes,
did they tell you or intimate what you were going to do with all this knowledge?
Translate orders. We were going to be a frontline, for one thing, translate orders. Two, we were to join a frontline broadcasting propaganda unit and to frighten the Japanese out of their holes in the mountains up in the Kohima areas and other areas of Burma, where they were, or wherever was necessary. And of course it came to an unfortunate end because somebody went up there with their big trucks and their big speakers, at least their small jeeps and their large speakers, and started doing this, and the Japanese, who were supposed to be, shall we say, enticed out of their holes, just loaded their mortars and blew them all to the devil. So the first thing they did was lose half their interpreters. That's a bit of an exaggeration. They lost five in that unit. So that wasn't very successful. The other thing was that if you were called by headquarters to do this sort of thing in Burma, the people who were fighting the war didn't like you a bit because you brought the fire down on them. Don't forget, in wartime, you're not really looking for a fight. You're looking, you have to advance sometimes. You hope that as the other guy, as you advance, the other chap retreats and doesn't make you have to go out and do a little bloodletting and get killed unnecessarily. This is psychologically quite true, I suppose. And so they resent anyone who, by virtue of their presence and bravado, and by virtue of their propaganda, brings the shellfire down upon the innocent troops who are simply sitting down brewing tea, waiting for things to happen.
Or not to happen, preferably.
Not to happen, preferably.
Where were you sent to in India when you left Canada?
We were sent to Bombay, and then we were sent into Pune for jungle training. And it's at Pune that the famous, or infamous, Canadian officers' mutiny began.
You told me about that, but I'd like you to tell me the story again.
Oh, boy. Must I?
Well...
Yes, of course. All right. I mean, I'm just... It's
give me the essence.
I don't want to tell... if you don't mind, I won't mention names, eh?
No, don't mention names. Just, no. Just give me the essence.
Well, the essence of the thing seems to me, if I recall it pretty well, seems to be this. We were sent down to Pune from Bombay headquarters to do jungle training. Now, the chaps with whom I went had a lot of them come from Prince Rupert and had done all their so-called jungle training or woods training up there. And they were fed up with hanging around doing nothing. They said, we were trained to come and do something in this war, and it cost a lot of money to train us, and what on earth are you doing retraining us? Maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong. But in any event, I was sent with them. And I was sent with them because it was said that I was the person who had the frontline experience, and therefore I could be a steadying influence or something.
And were you also being trained to be an agent who would be dropped behind enemy lines?
I don't think so. No. They wouldn't. Yes and no. I mustn't answer that question yet. That was part of the training, I'm sure. Jungle work is to survive in the jungle. We went in there. We were there for a week, and we were taught a number of things. I went down then with fever. I was ill when I went in, but I didn't stop. I went in anyway. When I got in, I was in my sack the whole time, to put it bluntly. I didn't do any training at all, that I recall. And apparently, in the midst of all this, one or two of our officers, and more than that, decided they'd had enough and they weren't going to stay there, and so when the inspector came along, or whoever it was came along, they just told him that they could stuff his course where the monkey put its nuts. And so everybody was hauled out, including me, sack and all, you know, sent back up to Pune headquarters. And in Pune headquarters, I'm afraid I was the only, I don't know what they said to anyone else, but I know they hauled me in alone. And the colonel there gave, as I recall it now, gave me particular hell because, again, I was a person who had fought with, under British command. I knew I had been in the front lines. It was expected that I would have been a person that would not have allied myself with any such undertakings as had been going on. Of course, I hadn't. I was pretty well, if you like, stewed out with... I think it was either malaria or... Actually, it wasn't. It was dengue. It was dengue fever that knocked me out. And so I just stood there and take it because it was not... What could you say? I was there and what the hell? I was with the troops and that was that. However, apparently somebody already had the thing out of the bag and told the... whispered something in the colonel's ear. And more or less in the middle of the harangue, I was unharangued. And sent to the hospital. I never heard any more about it. But you see, that sort of thing follows around. And even much later on, in Singapore, when we were down to Singapore, I come up against one chap who said, oh, of course I know, you're one of those people that was in the the Poona Mutiny. I said, yes, I was present when the mutiny took place. I didn't take place, didn't take part in it. And there was never very much said about that. But the Poona Mutiny was so short-lived but effective, we were all moved out of Poona. I went over to operations, 1B Judges Court Road.
In Poona? Bombay?
Calcutta.
Calcutta.
I was sent to 1B Judges Court Road. And from 1B Judges Court Road, I went on my way. And how did it all work out? I went on board a British vessel. The British vessel took me across and landed me off Port Swettenham.
I'm sorry, I don't
care. Port Swettenham's on the coast of Malaya, not too, just slightly south of Penang.
And now, what is the date? What are we talking about?
We're talking about a date that's just about equal with the surrender.
About August.
Yeah.
1940.
Yeah. And from there into the old bush, that I, you know, it all happened very, very swiftly. Let me tell you, it was another frightening experience, and an awful lot of blockage here. I know that the surrender was announced. That we went down into Kuala Lumpur. That I was then seconded over to British intelligence, and I was officially joined onto Force 136 at that point.
At that point, you joined the force. Sorry, what was frightening about it? You said there was a frightening experience and hence a lot of blockage. What is the frightening experience?
I suppose the frightening experience is landing on enemy shore, if you like.
Except in the sense it wasn't.
It wasn't.
But you were returning to the experience of 42.
That's right. Correct.
So you're now officially a member of Force
136.
What happened?
I'm still held by the British and GSIB, whatever that was, which was counter. Because then we were trying to collect everybody they could that had been associating with the Japanese, put them in the bag. So it was supposed to be our job. And then I was suddenly called up by Force 136 and sent up to the area where I was had been operating, where I had left, strangely, Pahang, Temelo. So the circuit is complete. And I'm up there with this chap called Smith, as part of the British administration, holding this thing together and trying to hold off the communists or the Malayan People's Army. Now, the Malayan People's Army, as I think I told you before, was nothing more than a slightly more socialist idea than the idea of the CCF in the 1930s. But they were, of course, actually communist-backed. Let's face it, I know that now. And I stayed out there until I was called back.
What was your job?
My job down there was to get payover for rifles and arms from the Chinese and put them back into the civil population, if we could, to cooperate with the Malays who didn't like the Chinese, to cooperate more particularly in getting disarming as many as possible of the local Chinese, and with our Gurkhas keeping the peace and keeping the Malayan People's Army at a distance. You see, the Malayan People's Army had advanced in on the centers, trying to take over even as we came up. And I suppose Mr. Smith had, Captain Smith had had rather a lonely job until I arrived on the scene. And he wasn't a Far East man at all. I was the man who had the lingo and could deal with most of the situations and but of course I didn't speak Gurkhali, and he did. You know, it's one of these things where I speak one side and you speak the other. So between the two of us, I think we did a reasonably good job of keeping the peace until the administration got a little bit stronger. And then quite suddenly that fall, Mackenzie King discovered he had apparently had a whole lot of Canadian officers in Force 136 sitting on their prats in Malaya and Burma and Indochina and down in Java and Sumatra, and called us all back. So I caught the old USS Tennessee and...
Don't forget you're attached.
No, I won't forget I'm attached because I did, you know.
Hang on.
Greatly.
I just wanted to ask you if you could give me any more details about the kind of job you had in trying to disarm the Malayan people's army.
Oh, yes, right. All right.
How difficult was it?
It was an impossible feat. We went armed up with money, gold, sovereigns. At least I didn't have the gold sovereigns. Smith had the gold sovereigns. I had the language, and we would go and... First of all, there was no food where we were. There was no rice. There was nothing that had been done. Nobody had planted anything. It was completely disorganized. And the were very close by.
There was no food.
No food. And you have to understand that this was a Force 136 thing now. I'm separated out of GSIB. I'm over to Force 136, and I'm sent up in an old car with a couple of Gurkhas to this bloody outlying place where there is an old rest house. You know what I mean by rest house?
Not really.
A rest house is a stop-off place where, coming in by car or by horse, you would have stayed overnight, and where there was a cook and...
You remember the Raj?
Yes, that's right. And
okay,
so forth.
I understand.
Yeah. And here I met this chap, Smith, and here it was laid on what really we were trying to do, or what he'd been trying to do. So I said, well, there's no good fooling round here. I said, where's the government buildings? And he pointed sort of vaguely over to there, which was a little bit up the, really a little bit up the road, up the red laterite road. And he said, there's the government buildings. I said, well, who's there? Well, he said, I understand the commandant of the Malayan People's Army is in there. And I said, well, that's all right. What would you like me to do? Well, he said, well, what I would really like you to do is to see if you could persuade him to leave. And I said, I don't think you can persuade them to leave. Exactly. As a matter of fact, I said, if you really want to know, I have a great sympathy with them. But I go up and talk. You have a lot of arrogance when you're young and doing these sort of things.
And probably, did you have a great deal of sympathy with
them? I did. Oh, yes. Hell yes.
Why?
I had a great deal of sympathy because I began to realize that those who were coming back into Malaya were part of the old crew, and that the things that had been promised to be done obviously weren't going to be done because they were going to try and reorganize the Malaya under its old political organization. They weren't going to give it dominion status as it was supposed to get.
Why would that particularly bother you? If you had been a member of... If you were
It began to bother me when I was a member of GSIB. Because during the time that I was GSIB, I was working with Chinese most of the time. And most of those who were there, like Dr. Shi and a few others, were idealists who said to us, we're coming in, the thing's over now, we're looking forward to our dominion status self-government, and we're looking forward to doing things that we've always thought we wanted to do as a nation. We want to be Malayan people. But guess what's happening? In the meantime, of course, others of the old government are coming back from being... They've revived themselves, or they've been revived, or they've been temporarily put back into circulation, and because of their particular attitudes, the split between the Malays and the Chinese, which has always been there, is not in any way being mended, and as you know, never did mend to the extent that today Singapore is actually separate from Malaya. And the Malayan People's Army was not made up of Malays, it was made up of Chinese. It identified itself as Malayan, not Chinese. And as I say, I read their manifesto, both I didn't read it in Chinese, I read it in English. And I couldn't see anything very drastic about it then. Maybe I was still a little naive in those days. And their propaganda and so forth wasn't too bad as far as I was concerned. And anyway, the point of the fact of the matter is that when I went up with my file of Gurkhas to the government house, government buildings, there wasn't anybody there. They'd left it quite quietly and quite neatly, as a matter of fact, and had retreated off to the side of the town. Just sort of left, and I won't say they'd gone back into the jungle, but they set their headquarters up off to one side. So I just went in there, and old Smitty waved the Union Jack over the government buildings. Then when we did that, of course, some of the old clerks and so forth started to come back in. Then we started to organize we told them what we needed. They were Indian and or Chinese. We told them what, and or Malay. There were some Malays amongst them. The police were Malays always. And the local Chamber of Commerce wasn't Malay, of course, it was Chinese. It was organized. Its nucleus had never really died down even during Japanese times. And so I forget how it worked out anyway. My Malay was reasonably good. I could speak to the Chinese, and I could speak some of the Chinese who were the members of the local Chamber of Commerce and other small taukes round and about, knew who was who and what was going on and who had arms and who might be persuaded to part with their arms for a little money. So we decided to start to part, you know, to just simply do that, to pay people for bringing their revolvers and their 303s and their ammunition and their grenades and anything else that they had, machine guns, if they had them, Stens and the like. We paid them, I forget exactly how much per round or how much per gun, but there was a sort of set price set up depending upon the supply and demand. And rice and food. We had, the great thing we had was food. That brought them in.
You paid food for guns?
Food for guns.
Butter for guns.
Exactly, in a way. They fly the rice in big canisters, drop them off, and our Gurkhas go and collect them, and our Chinese people would go and collect them, and then we'd have soup. We'd have to measure the stuff out for the population, but we didn't particularly measure out any for the Malayan People's Army. Naturally, we weren't there to measure things out for Malayan People's Army. They weren't very well supplied. So gradually over time, I can't say we starved them or anything, they let them starve, but their people gradually came over. Food's a great, and of course, persuasion of their own clans. Don't forget the Chinese are quite clannish. The Lees will always look after the Lees, the Wans will always look after the Wans, the Wans and the Wongs, and so forth and so on. Who has a cousin who is a member of the people down would like to come home and look after his small farm down, which he had over in the paddy fields or over in the jungle over here, and which the Malays have taken over in the meantime. There's a Malay family living in there. And there were things like that happening all the time, you know.
Any violence in this?
Program? No, not really. People were too stunned, I think, to have too much violence.
So they didn't actually have any confrontation to it?
No, and anyway, you don't. Gurkhas are nasty little mean things in their way. And you take a few of those. You don't go without your threat. Let's put it that way. And they weren't sure about what the Raj was going to do anyway. They knew that, A, those who were friendly to the Raj were getting rice, that there was some money in circulation, that the water was being turned back on, the electric light, the big old diesels, which had we'd blown up when we left 4 years ago, were being put back in commission by the small Dukans, and we were getting parts up from, you know, here, there, and everywhere, and slowly things were being organized back into the old pattern. Note this, it's being organized back into the old pattern. And, but everybody always expected, we'll just get the old pattern going just to get things organized, and then, of course, we'll get our dominion status, and that's going to be that, and as you know, it didn't happen. But that was only one aspect of the whole thing. The other aspect of the thing was, of course, the Malayan People's Army was never really disbanded, ever. And it kept all the arms and all the caches of arms, and it was really, and it really then, even later, it will either then, later, even then it was evident, but later, of course, I think that the attitude of the administration and the, by 1949, of course, China was communist. The communist infiltration was much greater. It gathered strength and it gathered importance and it gathered force. And as you know, about 1948, the insurrection began. And of course, the insurrection was well and truly armed because they had all the arms that we'd supplied them with.
What you're saying, in fact, is that you were not successful in disarming the Malayan.
No, of course we weren't. It was a token thing we did. What we really did was went up there to reorganize and get the government going and disarm as many as possible and get people content so they didn't want to insurrect against.
Did a lot of the members of the Malayan People's Army hide their arms and come out and resume their normal lives?
Yes, I'm sure they did.
So you were led to assume that everything was normal, but in fact they had these arms cached.
They had the arms cached away inside. But of course that wasn't a particularly active thing at that point. People weren't thinking. If I read things aright, there were always these arms, caches of arms around, because we were cooperating with the Malayan People's Army, which was an army organized by the more militant forms of Chinese. Don't think that they were Malays. They were not. The Malays stuck to their own particular things. There may have been the odd Malay, of course, just as it was the odd Indian with them, East Indian. But the main and the big one, they were all Chinese. And they weren't Malay Chinese, we found out afterwards, too, as innocently stupid we were.
They were not.
They were not.
What were they?
They'd come in from down through Thailand and from China. They were all part of the gang that was already organized in Malaya, part of the thing that had been going on for several years. They started out with the main units of them were Chinese, Malayan Chinese. But then, as the Malayan Chinese went back into the fold and went back to their occupations, of peaceful occupations, and left their arms behind, a lot of them, or took their arms with them, or let us buy the worst of them, the others infiltrated in and filled the gap. So there were always a certain amount of Chinese nationals coming down through Malaya, through Burma, but not through Burma, through Siam, and so forth, down the coast any old way.
How long were you involved in this disarmament?
Disarmament, I would say from the day, practically from within 2 weeks of getting there until they took me out in what was it? Ooh, let's have a look, October, November.
October 45.
Yeah.
I think that's all the date October in there.
Yeah, somewhere I think we know, right from then on. And then just as suddenly we came out from Tembelo and we sent down to Singapore and put on board the ship and told to go home, much to our disgust. At least my disgust, anyway. I was just getting nicely on to the British Raj again.
Were you thinking of, could you have stayed? Would it have been possible to stay? Would you have wanted to stay?
I think I might have liked to have stayed, except for a rather gentle hint I was given that possibly those of us, particularly those of us who were occupied in the organization of disarming the so-called communists, wouldn't be very peaceful if anything ever broke out, or wouldn't be very safe if anything ever broke out. And so it turned out later.
So there were intimations that, in fact, this was a very temporary state of affairs.
Yes, there was intimations.
It
might say there was a sort of a truce as far as the Malayan People's Army was concerned, although as far as the members, local members of the Malayan People's Army was concerned, all they wanted to do was get back to either planting their paddy or get back into their trades or get back to their shops or whatever that they had been doing or get back to their families so that everything... See, that was the reason for rice and money and organizing and cooperating or getting the cooperation of the Chamber of Commerce. The big menace was not the Malay. The Malay was already set up by his Raja and any sort of loyalty he may have had to the Raj was, merely because he was hired by the Raj to the local government to be a policeman or to be a customs inspector. They had all the nice cinchy jobs. They had them all. And so they were quite prepared to put the Chinese in their place. And as long as they were peaceful, of course, they weren't left alone. I must say that the administration of law in Malaya was very good. And as soon, of course, the back influence of the British Raj came in, things seemed to settle down very quietly and very nicely in that initial period. But when we went down back into Singapore and then we were discussing these things later, my eyes were opened a little bit more by other people from Force 136 who came in and said, well, you probably shouldn't come back, friend, considering what you've been doing, because these people are not likely to forget that you were getting their people to leave the Malayan People's Army and go back to their ordinary occupations when they should have been helping to enforce the getting rid of the Caucasian as quickly as possible so that we can have another good Malayan Soviet running. So I didn't, and what happened later was indeed that several of us who had been engaged in that and did go back to planting were amongst the first slaughtered when the insurrection went. So I'm very glad he didn't go back.
I wouldn't be here talking to you.
Oh, maybe not, maybe. Maybe what I did was too insignificant to worry about. I didn't do it long enough. But certainly I got to know quite a number of the Malayan people, the army people. Certainly I had a good sympathy for them, I thought they were trying to do. Of course it came, I suppose, a little bit evidence as time went on that the type of propaganda they were setting out and putting on was strictly of a very crude nature, wherein Uncle Sam and the British were shown as you would think, even as you see it's the same sort of propaganda, I suppose, you see in South America, Central America today. The crude form of play showing the depressed, the oppressors, the very rich, and the poor slobs down below being ground into the dust. These small playlets were always coming out. So one began to realize that there was not quite as idealistic as it seemed, and not quite as idealistic as some of its own members thought it was. And this, I think, probably caused a good deal of the tightening up later. But, of course, and I think, as I said before, that the return of a good many of the old civil servants didn't help, although things had advanced sufficiently, thank God, by the time the insurrection did come, that there were enough Asians in high places, particularly in the police and the civil administration, that they were able to cope with the insurrection as a true police action, not an army action, which is the only reason they were able to quell it. That, I would say, is about it that I can think of. Now,